it hit me, you know, a year or two later, I guess, that why would I want to do good with just 1% of our income, 1% of our assets? So it hit me actually when I hit 400 team members or employees, I realized that I had people working about 1 million hours a year, you know, under my direction. I could, you know, essentially direct their time and energy and effort 1 million hours a year. And at that time, we were doing a few $100 million a year of revenue, and we were managing a few million billion dollars of assets. And we said, well, if we have all these assets and all this revenue and all this time, why would we want to just do good with 1% or a small percent of that? We want to do good with all of it.
Welcome to the Building Excellence Podcast. I'm your host, Bailey Miles. The Building Excellence Podcast is all about sharing inspiring stories from some of the most successful athletes, coaches, business minds, and thought leaders to help you build excellence in your life, leadership, and legacy. To learn more, visit baileymiles.com and be sure to rate, review, and follow us on all social media platforms. Now let's get to the show and start building excellence in your life, leadership, and legacy. Don Winter is the founder and CEO of DLP Capital, a private real estate investment and financial services firm focused on making an impact on American communities by acquiring, developing, and building relationships, housing, leaders, and organizations. Winter founded DLP Capital in 2006 and has since spearheaded its meteoric growth, with the firm ranking on the Inc. 5000 list of fastest-growing private companies in America for 10 consecutive years, among the few companies on the list to achieve such consistency. The firm now has more than $4 billion of assets under management. He originally formed DLP Capital, standing for Dream, Live, Prosper, as a small residential real estate sales firm in the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania, not far from Philadelphia. Within 5 years, he had expanded the firm to include an investment portfolio of real estate rentals along with property management, and soon after, under Winter's stewardship, the firm added real estate brokerage and construction affiliates and had grown to a team of 100 employees and now over 400 plus. This Elite Execution System, or EES, is today a hallmark of Winter's success. Winter became a best-selling author in a book that elaborates on this EES model, Building an Elite Organization, the Blueprint to Scaling a High-Growth, High-Profit Business. The book, a Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and Amazon bestseller, also elaborates on other best-in-business practices for 10xing growth, as well as focusing on core values that contribute to driving greatness. Earlier this year, he released his newest book, Building Elite Career, which is the blueprint to thriving in a high-growth organization. Among additional noteworthy milestones in Don Winter's career, he has closed more than 28,000 real estate transactions, overseen the acquisition of 30,000-plus homes and apartments, and impacted more than 838,000 lives through DLP Capital's affordable housing initiatives. Under his leadership, DLP Capital consistently receives regional accolades as a best places to work, among other awards of distinction. For more on Don and DLP, check out dlpcapital.com. And for more on his books, check out dlpelite.com. Enjoy the show. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Building Excellence Podcast. Today, I have a special guest, Don Winter, with me. Don, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thanks, Billy. Pleasure to be here with you today.
Yeah. Well, if you wouldn't mind, maybe give our listeners maybe some context to you and your background and what life was like growing up for you.
Sure. My name is Don Winter. I'm father of three sons, 11, 10, and 2. We live in St. Augustine, Florida with my wife, Carla. I started my organization, DLP Capital, see here kind of on my shirt, about 17 years ago now, in a town called Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Probably best known today for Lehigh University, originally sort of best known for being the steel capital of the world, Bethlehem Steel. But it's about an hour north of Philadelphia, and grew up to two young parents who had me at 16 years old. I'm the oldest of five, and grew up with the amount of resources that you would expect two 16-year-olds to have. So my dad was a prison guard most of my childhood, correction officer, and my mom ran a home daycare. They divorced when I was very young, moved between their households, lived in 37 different households. By the time I moved out of my parents' house as a 17-year-old, a junior in high school, I went out on my own and determined I was going to support myself. And then a couple years later, while I was in college, stumbled into real estate and starting, you know, what today is DLP Capital. So been a great, great journey, a lot of fun. And that's the quick version of my backstory.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely dive into starting DLP, but just kind of going into what you talked about with your family and growing up in an environment where you had divorced parents, they had you at 16. What are some things that you learned from them while you were growing up that maybe had an impact on you, maybe even in the moment or maybe later looking back as now you're a parent and owning businesses and things like that? But what are some qualities that you appreciate that you did learn or maybe even don't appreciate? I don't know, however that
Yeah,
works.
I'd say the most important lesson, I learned, and the best part of my childhood was, and I didn't recognize it at the time, to be honest, but is, I grew up in faith, grew up in with a relationship with the Lord, grew up Catholic, went to Catholic school off and on during my childhood, but always had a strong sense of belonging, always had a strong relationship with the Lord, never have been in a position where that's been, questioned for me. And part of that was, growing up in an overall pretty large family, who, who loved me and were filled with believers. And so I think that was the really, really critical foundation, that gave me the confidence to go out and pursue my dreams and leverage the blessings that have been provided to me. On the other side, although that was the way I took from it as a child and why I felt really confident, I think part of why I felt really confident at a very young age was always the belief that, I could do whatever I wanted to. There were no ceilings, there were no limits. Believed in the growth mindset before I knew what that was, of, that if you're willing to do the work to learn and to do, you can accomplish anything. But unfortunately, my family didn't have that same kind of belief set, and I grew up in a household of very, very low ceilings and very much limits to what could be done, and very much the mindset of, well, we didn't come from money or didn't come from this, you don't have this knowledge, you don't have this experience, so we can't do it. Right? More the mindset of, we got to, for the rest of our lives, figure out how to pinch pennies, because there's no way we can make more dollars. And so that's a lot of how my family all grew up, and nobody went to college, nobody owned a business, everybody made pretty, low incomes. And that's what kind of surrounded me at the time. And I've been very blessed, though, that my father has worked for me now for 16 years. My mom worked for me for 15 years and retired last year. My stepfather for 10 plus years, my stepmother for 10 plus years, a lot of my family. So their ceilings have lifted a little bit, but that would be some of the lessons from my childhood.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are great lessons. And kind of going into that growth mindset, where do you think that was kind of initiated within you to have that? And maybe what were the things you were doing to kind of grow as a young person, even maybe all the way from middle school into high school? And I know you stepped out when you were 17, but maybe even going back as far as you can remember, how has your mind always been a growth mindset, and how were you able to kind of encourage and grow in that regard towards life?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. I spent before we got started, we talked a little bit about this. I spent I'd say the first 7, 8 years of my two older children's, who are 11 and 10 now, their childhood really focused on trying to instill grit, instill the focus of hard work, perseverance, commitment in them. And for the last 2 or 3 years, I'd say I've really spent the largest amount of time trying to focus on making sure, they have a growth mindset, making sure they understand that it's not, there's no secret to how you accomplish what you want in life. It's if you're willing to, you have to be willing to put forth the work to do and to learn, and that there is no limit. And I think there's a lot of very motivated people in the world who have very limited beliefs, and have the opposite of a growth mindset, have a fixed mindset. And just, to use an example, if two children were in high school and they were both, say, in, chemistry, and they both really wanted to get A's in chemistry, and they both studied really hard, and they both went and took their big exam, and they both didn't do very well. Let's say they both got a C. The child with a fixed mindset would tend to have beliefs of, oh, I'm just not good at chemistry. Or maybe feel, oh, the professor didn't put what he told us he was going to put on the exam, and he didn't teach us this or didn't tell us this, or they'd have some sort of mindset that, there's nothing I can do about it, it wasn't my fault, and they'd be very upset and disappointed, but the focus would be on, nothing I can do, it was out of my control, it wasn't my fault. Somebody with a growth mindset would get that same grade, be disappointed, but they'd want to know, what did I get wrong so that next time I can get it right? Because they have the belief that every opportunity is a learning opportunity and I can grow and I can learn and I can get better. This isn't a final point. And we've all heard many people in our lives, and we've all been guilty. I've myself as well of saying things like, oh, that's just who I am. I'm just not good at that. And it's a very different mindset. And the book on this is called Mindset by Carol Dweck. She's sort of the best thought leader in this topic. And so I know all this now today and can clearly understand the growth mindset and can clearly focus on instilling it in my children and paying attention for it and reinforcing it. Which is great. And that's the whole concept of growth mindset. You can learn anything. And and I think like anything in life, you know, every one of us, you know, is born or comes through our childhood with a different set of blessings, different natural skill sets or natural tendencies, or maybe they're not always natural, but shaped tendencies that we didn't, you know, intentionally think through. And, you know, for me, I don't know what exactly it was that I always had a growth mindset. You know, when I was in 8th grade, a financial advisor came into Career Day, and he showed us this little chart that showed that financial advisors made more money than doctors, lawyers, accountants. So they listed out, you know, compensation, and financial advisors were at the top of his chart. And so I'm in 8th grade. I'd already been running multiple small businesses at that point. I was very entrepreneurial. And what he took, or at least what I took from what he said as an 8th grader, was to be a great financial advisor, you had to be entrepreneurial and you had to be good at math. And I was great at math and I was very entrepreneurial. I said, well, that's me. So I started shadowing financial advisors, this gentleman included, in 8th grade. And I'd go on appointments with them. And I remember the first time I went on an appointment with this gentleman, I had my notepad, kind of like I have right here. And we're out on an appointment with a client. I'm taking notes and I'm listening. And she tells me her sister's, she tells him, not me, her sister's about to retire and this and that. I'm taking all these notes. Then we go to lunch afterwards and I say, hey, so are you going to follow up with her sister, Nina? And he's like, what are you talking about? I said, well, he said, if sister retire, I would think that's a, you know, change of event. And I remember that I went and shadowed with him again. And I said, hey, what happened with the sister? And he's like, what are you talking, you know? And I knew in 8th grade I could do this guy's job better than him, not when I was an adult, but right now, right? I was like, I can do this right now, right? I can do this in 8th grade. And I just always had that kind of mindset because I knew I'm going to listen, I'm going to work hard, I'm going to learn, I'm going to study. And I came to him asking him all these different trends about wealth transition, and he didn't even know what I was talking about, right? And this was a guy who'd been doing it 20 years. So I've just always had that belief that I'm curious and I'm going to learn, I'm going to work really hard. And so, you know, I can't say what put that in me other than, you know, blessing from God, but I've always had that confidence that if somebody else can do it, there's no reason I can't.
Yeah, well, and I love that you touched on it's a blessing from God. That's kind of your natural makeup. But even for people that don't have that natural makeup, it can be learned and it can be grown within you
Exactly.
to be able to have that. But having the idea behind listening, learning, working hard, and then just going after those things are things
Yeah.
that obviously you're doing at a lot younger age, probably than most people at 8th grade. But you touched on curiosity. It seems like you're always someone who was curious. You know, what did it look like if you kind of were able to go in and shadow people at 8th grade, and then kind of getting to being 17 and jumping into living on your own? Were you always geared towards being a financial advisor, and how did kind of that play out for you as you kind of moved into college and stepping away from kind of living with your family?
Yeah, so thank you. And yeah, so when I was a junior in high school, it kind of wasn't really a planned thing, but one day I had an argument with my parents and they said, if you think you know so much better than us, then go do it yourself. And so I moved out that day and I determined I'm never coming back. I'm never asking for a dollar. I'm never, you know. And so I went and waited tables then through my junior year and senior year of high school, and knew I wanted to be a financial advisor, and applied for schools, and luckily because of, you know, good SAT scores and grades, I got, you know, close to a full ride and to Drexel University. And but I knew thought I was gonna be a financial advisor. I actually got my licenses as soon as I turned 18 and I could, but I figured, hey, I need to get a degree. And so I worked at companies like BlackRock and McGladrey & Poland and some big companies in college, but knew hey, I was an entrepreneur, I was gonna be a financial advisor, I have control of my income and so forth. And while I did that, I continued in college to wait tables on the weekends. And I was a bit, you know, a bit in a rush then, probably two more than I'd recommend my children or others to be. You know, I went to two colleges at the same time so I could take more classes. So I was taking 31, 33 credits at a time. I worked a full-time job and restaurant on the weekends, and I was, I was trying to get a 5-year program done with 2 years of internships in 3 years. And so I was, but I knew what I was going to do. And so when I had about, I guess maybe 2 semesters left, 3 semesters left, I started waiting table. While I was waiting tables, a guy convinced me to come work for him selling alarm systems. And if you ever worked restaurants before, they, work in a restaurant, they'll do things like, hey, whoever sells the most filet mignons tonight makes $20 or $50 or something. So that night it was filet mignons, so I was selling everybody a filet mignon, and which isn't too hard because the filet is pretty good,
Pretty
right?
good,
But
yeah.
and this is at Texas Roadhouse. Everybody know Texas
Oh,
Roadhouse?
that's the
Yeah,
best
where,
spot that, yeah,
yeah,
that's the best
exactly. So they're
place.
pretty good steaks. So, but this guy, who was a sales guy, and his name is Nathan Robinson, and he knew I was, trying to sell the table, and did. And so he came up to me after at the end of the night and said, hey, I really want you to come talk to me about coming to work for me. I'm in the security business. Didn't know what that meant. Didn't really know what he did. I'd never had an alarm system, a security system, and that was this business, ADT Security. And so anyway, I went to meet with him the next morning, and he told me if I came to work for him, and I was 19 years old, that I would make $2,000 a week is what he told me. And I said, well, I'm going to school full time. And he said, yeah, absolutely. You make $2,000 a week. I said, all right. I believed him for some reason. First paycheck was $5,280. I was making $5,000 to $8,000 every 2 weeks. And he also was a real estate agent. And so I was one night on one Friday evening, I was at his house, and he was signing me my check for the last 2 weeks. And I saw a $17,000 commission check on his table and an $18,000 commission check on his table. And I said, what's that all about? And he says, my real estate business. And we got into a conversation. He said, Don, if the way you sell alarm systems, you could sell real estate, right? And at this time, I didn't know any of this, but I found out much later. But I was the number one sales rep in America for ADT Security, which was about 100,000 sales reps. He never told me that. He also never told me that that he never had anybody make $1,000 a week before me. So, but because he set these expectations that this was normal, I just thought I was doing a good job, but didn't know I was doing anything abnormal, right? So he convinced me. I basically gave up sleep for about 3 weeks, took my classes online, and got my real estate license that day. I flew to a real estate marketing conference in Arizona. Walked out of that conference with a marketing message of your home sold guaranteed or I'll buy it. And that was October 2006, and that was the peak of the real estate market in the last cycle. So homes were slowing down, market wasn't going very well. So people were responding to this message. I mean, due to a lot of literal knocking on doors, but it would pique their interest enough I could get inside people's houses and talk to them, and that led to us helping people sell their home, and that led to us starting to buy homes and flip them. That led to us needing construction to self-perform. That led to then building a portfolio and property management. That led to needing more capital and raising private investment funds, and so forth.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in just what you shared, but one thing that I was thinking about as you're talking is, stepping into being a waiter, and trying to sell people on fillets, and then stepping into selling security systems, and then stepping into houses, each time you were selling. But what do you think it was, if you were to give someone advice on selling, what made you such a great salesman, and what were those things that you were doing to build rapport with people and to make them trust you and to be able to be good at what you're doing?
I could give you, some really great response that I'm just, incredibly skilled salesperson. But the reality is the number one reason I was successful in sales was I knocked on more doors than anybody else, period. So when I sold alarm systems, I sold one alarm system per 51 doors, I figured out. And it steadily got a little better over time, but certainly I did a lot of testing and a lot of things to get better, but I can say with almost 100% certainty, I knocked on more doors than anybody else, right? And I used to have the mindset, and I'm not talking figurative, I'm talking literal. And then, but then it was, all right, now I did all this work, spent 3 hours knocking on doors to get into somebody's house and sell them alarm system. How do I turn this into 2 sales, right? And asking for referrals and not be afraid to ask. And all right, I'm getting in front of doors and people are saying no. How do I improve success? So it was a lot of just going out there, knocking on doors and trying, right? Like I learned after a while that I'd say, hey, I'd like to, Hey, my name is Don Winter. I'm a sales rep with ADT Security here. We're doing a special promotion, $99 security systems. Let me tell you more. And I learned if I stood up, oh, I'm always standing up and I'm holding my pad. If I put my head down and I just started walking, people would get out of my way and they didn't want me to run them over and they let me just walk in there, right? And I would just not even wait for an answer, right?
Okay.
Or when they say, well, I don't have time right now. Let me, follow up. So, why don't I give you a call and follow up? Your phone number is 484. And I just start with their phone number and they say, oh, that's not my phone number, but because I started it, right? Or when I'm taking down somebody's information, going for the sale, saying, so your credit card number is 5421. That's not my credit card. Oh, okay. Sorry. That must be mine.
Okay.
And just assume the close, right? Assume they're going to go to the next step and have confidence that they will. But the biggest thing was I knocked on a lot of doors and that allowed me to get better and improve my skills. And then, last thing I'd say is, I was always confident and I've always been confident, whatever I'm selling that I'm helping people. And so, when you experienced when very early on in my ADT security career, I showed up to people's houses who had just been broken into, or I won't, bring down the temper of this conversation, talk about some of the things I saw that people experienced when they got broken into and things that happened to children and wives. But when you've seen that happen a few times, it became very easy to be confident that an alarm system would decrease the probability of that happening, could save somebody's life or save something really bad happening. And, same thing when I got into real estate, I believed what I was going to do a better job than anybody else in selling their home, that I could take away their risk, I could help them get to their next spot, et cetera. So, but fundamentally, it's working hard and believing in what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, as you can tell within your story already, you don't have to talk about working hard. You're just doing it. And so there's no question about that. But even going into maybe stepping into something where doing something where you're knocking on doors, obviously you're putting in the reps. So you're working hard. You're doing a lot of doors. You're knocking on people's doors, getting to interact with them. What are maybe some things that helped you just step into maybe, I don't know if that was easy for you to do or just naturally uncomfortable, but sometimes we have this idea behind not wanting to be uncomfortable and stepping into discomfort and trying to get our mindset shifted to where let's try to do some hard things. Let's step into this. And I mean, I'm not trying to act like I know I need to do that myself, but how do we be able to step into what you're talking about and step into that discomfort, step into the things you don't want to do and just go for it, put your head down, walk forward, and make something happen and always be moving.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's, a few parts to it. I'd say, one of the things that Nathan, who brought me into ADT security sales, would often say to me is, the mailman delivers mail, every day of the week, rain or shine, right? Cold or hot, right? Because, when you're in door-to-door sales or, the example of not being comfortable, you don't want to go out and do it when it's cold. You don't want to go out and do it when it's raining. You don't want to go out and do it when it's really hot, right? The mailman's out, right? Why aren't you out there, right? Kind of mindset, right? And mailman, isn't getting, commissions, isn't getting paid more to be out there. But he has to do it, right? And there's lots of other examples of that, people in construction trades, people outside and not desirable, not comfortable, to use your word, conditions are out there, doing so. So I say that's, was just an important, reminder to me. But I think, I've over the years, I didn't know this at the time, but over the years, I've developed I've spent a lot of time in thought and talking with really successful people in lots of different walks of life and trying to figure out, what are the things that make, the most successful people in the world successful? What do they have in common? What are the things that if you chose to do or you committed to doing, you could have, incredible success, significance, fulfillment in your life? And I came up with six keys or six commitments. And the first is intentionality. So being very intentional about what you're doing, knowing, the reason behind what you're doing and having a plan, a purpose, behind not just the big picture, what you're doing, but each thing you're doing, each task you're doing, intentionally knowing why you're doing it. That's number one, intentionality. And that applies across all areas of life. Two is having clear, purpose. Three is having very clear goals. Fourth is grit. Fifth is having a growth mindset, which we already talked about. And six, the sort of secret kind of sauce across all of that is being present, having presence in what you're doing. And so, for me and going and knocking doors, I mean, sales, I very, very much knew where I wanted to go, very much knew why I was out doing what I was doing, had very clear goals, certainly was, you know, for the most part gritty and had a growth mindset. And so that bare purpose, you know, that motivation, that drive, those goals, things I wanted to accomplish, you know, made it easy, right? I knew what I had to do. And I had enough drive, enough meaning to behind what I wanted to accomplish, by when, that, you know, gave me the motivation to be out there, and to work hard and you know, not be afraid to knock on those doors. And it was never fun, right? It was rarely ever did you say, I really feel like today going on knocking on a couple hundred people's doors and bothering people and having people unhappy and having dogs chase me or people slam the doors or whatnot. But then you also realize very quickly, I'm an optimist, but you know, I believe there's good in almost everybody. And that, you know, people aren't nasty and aren't angry. And most people, you know, the fear of people not literally, you know, literally knocking, you know, shutting the door in your face. It happened every now and then, but most part, yeah, people were busy and they were making dinner and they had to go places. But you know, I felt, you know, good about what I was doing. I knew I was out there to serve and rarely had people actually, you know, nasty or you know, really unhappy.
Yeah, I think what you just said, just out there to serve, is really important, and you know why you're doing it. Those six keys that you just talked about are all critical components of, you know, finding significance and success. But as well, I love the idea behind the mailbox, or the, not the mailbox mentality, but the mailman mindset. I just wrote that down. I thought that's great. But as you were moving into the real estate business, you started acquiring lots of homes, single family homes, and talk a little bit about how that kind of lifted up to go on and become DLP.
Yeah. So I started as a real estate agent, as mentioned, and this was 2006. So the market was turning, but it was also kind of the peak of everybody was a real estate investor. And so I started off helping people buy real estate and helping people flip houses in addition to helping people sell their homes. So I was, you know, working the role of real estate agent. And I never invested in real estate myself, but, you know, I was good at math. And so I was literally, you know, doing and helping people analyze real estate and is it going to cash flow and helping people, you know, make sense of buying properties. And so I was helping this gentleman named Jack buy this house. We were under contract to buy it. And we were I went to the closing table to meet the seller and meet my client for him to buy this home. He was going to renovate and flip. And I'm sitting across a conference room table in a real estate brokerage office from this old lady named 82-year-old lady named Eleanor. And I'm sitting around my client. It's 10 minutes past, 15 minutes past closing time. He hasn't shown up. I'm calling him. He doesn't pick up. Calling him. He doesn't pick up. Small talking with Eleanor. I think 40 minutes have gone by now. And he's still not there. And I try him again. He finally picks up and I say, Jack, where are you? You know, I'm at the closing table. He says, Don, I couldn't get my hard money loan. I'm not buying the house. Sorry. Click. And so I have to go back into the conference room, tell Eleanor that my client isn't going to buy her home. And she breaks into tears. She's crying hysterically. She's so upset. She tells me if she doesn't have the money today, she's going to get kicked out of the assisted living facility she's living in. You know, she's beside herself. So in that moment I decided, I'm going to buy her house. And so this is not at all an exaggeration. I'm at a closing table and there's a highway there in Bethlehem called 512. And literally I could see it from the conference room I'm sitting in, a bank across the street, which was my bank at the time, PNC Bank. And so I literally ran across the highway, went into PNC Bank, withdrew almost all the money I had, which was $72,000, came back, gave the cashier's check to close the table, and I bought her house. And that's how I, you know, how I ended up buying my first investment property. And so I renovated that home, hired a contractor I'd met, renovated it and flipped it. And funny enough, you guys could look this up. It's 226 Church Street in Catasauqua, Pennsylvania. And not only was it the first home I ever bought, first home I ever flipped, unfortunately, the home went into foreclosure and I actually bought it the second time in 2012, renovated again and flipped it twice. So my first ever property I owned twice and flipped it twice. That's the only house that's ever happened. But yeah, so that was the first one. And I did it. I said, well, this wasn't that hard. And And so did it a few more times, and then that started growing, and then built construction to support that, and then started having people who couldn't afford to buy homes because they just had a foreclosure or a short sale or whatever the case was in that depth of the market and needed a place to live. And so I was like, I started keeping properties as rentals and renting them out to people. And that's how we started building a rental portfolio. And so it naturally kind of everything came from just trying to come up with solutions to solve people's problems. At one point, we were one of the largest, if not the largest, short sale negotiation company in America. Before people even knew what short sales were, I literally was just calling banks like, hey, this house is only worth 150 grand. Client owes you 200 grand. What can we do? Right. Before anybody had departments to do this or anything, I was like, there's got to be solutions here. Nobody wants a foreclosure. Everybody loses. So it just came from trying to solve problems. And then with time, after a lot of experience, we realized, all right, what are the most scalable ways, you know, that we can make an impact on? What we focus on is creating housing that is and will remain affordable for working families. That's our focus, attainable workforce housing. And so we've now over the years figured out more scalable ways we can do that than just buying one house here and one house there. But that's how it all started.
Yeah. Well, gosh, I mean, when I think of what you're talking about, just something that comes to mind first is the ability to adapt and find solutions, but also it seems like you have a bias towards action. Like, how has that always been the makeup that you've had whenever something like that happens or your first deal and you decide to go buy the house? I mean, what was going through your mind there? Because that's not something that probably a lot of people would necessarily think of first and foremost. I'll just buy this lady's house.
Yeah.
Let's go for it. So.
Yeah. I think, you know, my coach, Jackie, has been kind of my business and personal coach for a number of years now. She likes to say, you know, there's always, for every light, there's a shadow. And, you know, so for every great trait that somebody has, right, you know, there's a weakness on the other side of it, right? So the strength there that you just said is, yeah, I have an extreme bias to action, an extreme sense of urgency, always. And I've, you know, I say I've hopefully as I've matured and grown in some wisdom, I've tempered it a little bit better. But on the other side of that is, and it can often be an extreme impatience. But yeah, I've always had just this action, you know, focus to take action, this bias, this urgency to do something now. This, you know, I spent a lot of time and thought on that wasn't a great example of it, but spent a lot of time thinking things through. But then once I make decisions, or I feel I know enough of the facts to make a decision, you know, I want it to happen. I want to have it now. I don't want to wait. You know, funny kind of personal story to that. So I met my wife, June of 2010, one night. We went on our first date on July 1st. I proposed middle of August, and we were married by November, right? So okay. It's a perfect example. Like, you know, I knew on the first date. So if I felt I was being patient, I didn't want to be crazy and wait at least 6 weeks. I thought I was being patient, right? But that was hard to wait 6 weeks. Then it was hard to wait 3 months because I already knew. I made up my mind there was no point in waiting. And now we're about to celebrate 13 years. So hopefully she still feels it was a good decision.
Yeah. That's not the formula for everybody, but I think a great perspective from you. You know, 13 years of marriage, 3 kids, it worked out. So I'd say that's a pretty wise decision.
Yeah.
But I think what you talked about, having a bias towards action, assessing things, making a decision, you know, it's not like you're just rapidly just going for something without any thought. You're thinking things through and then stepping into the decision that you make and going all in towards it. I think there's a lot of value in that. And you can see that within the story that you've said. Kind of jumping into DLP and what you just shared about kind of growing the real estate side of the business, how did you guys decide to really scale it up? And what was your thought process? And how did you go about assessing opportunities in real estate? Because there's a lot of different ventures. You're obviously in single family. But how did you kind of consolidate in multifamily and really expanding that?
Yeah. So like I mentioned in the beginning, it kind of happened the way I described, centered around helping homeowners, you know, work through their issues. And that led to, you know, doing all the things that we just talked about. And then, you know, in about 2014, so we were about 8 years into our journey. At that point, I owned about 700 properties, had about 100 employees, team members. And, let's say I sort of came up for air. So up until this point, you know, we had grown by over 50% in revenue growth every year for 8 straight years, you know, on a rocket pace, consistent growth. We've actually grown now over 50% of revenue growth every year for 17 years. But at this point, you know, we're kind of halfway through and we were like, looking, this is the time of groups like American Homes for Rent and Blackstone, all these groups starting to build these single family rental portfolios. And I was looking, I was like, you know, we can do it. There's no reason we couldn't do exactly what some of these groups are doing right now, but just didn't feel very scalable to say, because we didn't want to, you know, we weren't trying to double. It was like, all right, we're going to be 10 times this size in 5 years. We're going to be 100 times this size in 10 years. Can we do that efficiently in this space? And I remember going to a real estate conference in New York. I think it was, I don't remember, maybe it was an IMN conference or something. But I drove into New York City from Pennsylvania, and I got there a few minutes late, hit normal New York City traffic. And so I hustle into this big meeting room, and I, you know, quietly open the door and sit down because the speaker is already talking. And I happen to sit right in the front row at the first table. And I sit down quietly, put my bag down, I look up, and Sam Zell is sitting right in front of me. You know, the CEO of Equity Residential, unfortunately passed away recently. And that was the first time I met Sam. I didn't really know that much about him. I've had the pleasure of having some great conversations with Sam since and getting to know him. But at the time, I didn't really know that much. But I saw him up there, and he's got a strong personality, and he's up there with the CEOs of a lot of the biggest kind of private equity and private equity, real estate focused firms in the world. So these are all guys, like seven of them up on stage, and each one of them is managing 10 billion, 20 billion, 100 billion. And I'm sitting around on the table and talking to different people. And there was a young analyst sitting next to me who worked for Lazard Management, which is like a $50 billion firm. And I'm asking, well, tell me about the business. 50 billion assets. Wow. How many employees do you have? And all of a sudden I'm realizing, wait a second, there's these organizations managing, at the time I'm managing $20 million or $50 million, or maybe not that little, but $100 million or something, right? I'm realizing, wow, like, look at these such more scalable business models than what we're doing. And it was kind of an eye-opening experience, just kind of seeing these big, huge firms. And so kind of started going on a path saying, well, what's the best way, you know, for us to scale this focus around creating, investing in attainable workforce housing? And we landed on two strategies at that time. And there, you know, in hindsight, there were a couple others we could have went down that would have been very logical as well, such as at the time it wasn't, you know, like home building as an example, which we didn't focus on at that time. But two things we focused on was large scale multifamily. Felt, hey, it's very similar business to what we're doing, but with scale, 200 units at a time instead of one. And then private lending. So we kind of went from being a single family operator to being a large scale multifamily operator and a single family lender. So we started, instead of buying single family and flipping, started lending to people buying single family homes and flipping them. In fact, we actually started all the deals we were buying, we started turning them over to other flippers and giving them the money to do it instead of doing the work. And those were two really scalable business models. And that allowed us to quickly scale from owning 600-700 units to, you know, today about, you know, 18,000 rental units. And, you know, go from flipping one home at a time to doing 100 plus, you know, loans to home flippers a month. And then steadily that grew. And as we started built expertise in multifamily, then we started lending to multifamily operators, and our lending business started getting more scalable. And then we started doing, you know, large scale ground up development and lending to ground developers. And then we started doing joint ventures with some of the best developers and operators. And so it was a natural, you know, evolution of just finding more scalable ways to create housing that is and remain affordable.
Yeah. And as you tell that story, the one thing that comes out to me is the growth mindset, always thinking of opportunities next. You're going through things, you're learning, you're assessing, you're surrounding yourself with great people, being around all those guys that you're around early on. But also, I know you've done that as well throughout your career to this day. What are some things you take away from being in rooms with some of those people that really have helped you think differently? And maybe what are those common characteristics or traits of the people that you get to spend time with?
Yeah, thank you. Earlier this morning, I led a 2-hour workshop here at DLP called Building an Extraordinary Life, Having Your Best Year Ever While Building an Extraordinary Legacy. And I did that for all of our employees and had a lot of our investors come and join too. And so we just finished this. And one of the questions somebody asked me was about, because one of the things I talked about in this training was, you know, a lot of us focus on what we want to accomplish and we set these goals and priorities. But what I believe is as valuable or more important when we think about what we want to do in our lives is who we're going to do life with. And And so we were talking about that, and then we have this tool we call our tribe roadmap, and where you think about, who we want to be a part of our life and what sort of buckets they fill. And one of those is mentors and coaches and so forth. And somebody in the group asked, a young team member asked, how do you go about getting mentors, and how do you get people to support you that you want to learn from? And so I told the story that I hadn't thought of in a while. I'm really say that when I first got into real estate sales, I figured out Craigslist had just came out. So I guess I'm making myself sound a little old now.
Yeah, you're not
So
that old.
I started posting a lot of ads on Craigslist, which was free, and getting leads and ultimately selling homes at no cost, but the time to do it. And so I started calling the top real estate agents around the country. Called about 50 of them, and told them, "Hey, I can come show you how to sell 100 homes a year on Craigslist for free. Would you like to meet?" And every one of them was yes. So all of a sudden, I got in the door with all the top 50 real estate to the meeting, and I'd have the instructions on how to do it, and I'd sit down with their marketing person or whatever and show them how to do it. And then I'd sit down with the CEO, and I'd have my notepad with 3 pages of questions. And start drilling in with them. And then as they're giving me answers, now, especially once I met with a few, now I had feedback, what other people told me, which they hadn't done that work, and said, "Oh, so-and-so is doing something similar, but they're doing this." And all of a sudden, I'm at the time, I'm 20 years old, right? And they're like, took a liking to that, and all of a sudden started inviting me to these different mastermind groups. And what I found over the years is to get, in the room with the best people and whatever you want to do, or get the attention of people that you think have expertise that you could learn from. If people who are, successful in whatever way that means for what you're looking for, believe that you're going to do something with the time they spend with you, are going to actually take action from what they teach you or show you. Most really salespeople want to help other people, want to help people be successful. What they don't want to do is they don't have a lot of is time to waste. And so what I've tried to do to make that easier, I mean, if you don't have something you can offer, don't think you do, you probably do. If you simply just follow up more than once, and you'll probably get somebody, people you want to talk to respond to you and give you some time. But if you can give something of value, like the example I gave, you're going to get people's to attention and get time and get that at bat to meet and learn and build a relationship. So I've just kind of kept that approach as I've gone through my career, and having this growth mindset, I've always believed that, hey, anytime I want to go do something new or different that I don't know how to do, I'm just going to go find the people who are already doing that and build a relationship with them. And it's not hard. You just figure out who they are, which, if they're good at what they do, that's pretty easy. And then you go where they are, go to the events they are at, reach out to them, and learn from them. And then one of the other great things to do is, in today's world, is this is the information age. The information's everywhere. It's all over the place. There's tons of great podcasts, tons of incredible books. So I'm a voracious reader. I mainly do it on listening, but I complete about 50 or 60 books a year. I start 150 books a year. And so I do a lot of reading. And so what I found early in my career is I'd read and go meet and learn from a lot of experts. But a lot of the, kind of experts or thought leaders, kind of tend to have a tendency of making you believe, especially all the books and content out there, that there's some silver bullet out there, right? And so if you just got good at content marketing, or you just got good at hiring, or you just got good at leadership, or you just got good at checklists, if you just got good at setting clear strategy, if you just got good at culture, it would solve everything, right? And so what I learned relatively early on is that that's not accurate, and that you have to have a clear strategy, a clear plan that pulls all the different pieces together. And so about now, I guess about 12 years ago, we started building what today we call the Elite Execution System. And the way I think about it is there's four quadrants to a business: strategy, people, operations, and acceleration, which is sales and marketing, customer service. And they all have to work together a part of one plan. And so I'll give credit, which my book, which is called Building, the first book is called Building an Elite Organization. I highlight and reference all the great experts that have come before me. Gino Wickman, who's the founder of EOS, wrote a book called Traction. He's the first person who actually read my book. Guys like Vern Harnish, John Maxwell, Jim Collins, Sean Covey, lots of great experts out there that I've taken their their ideas and their systems and their tools and built them, you know, into what we do, which is a really, really disciplined way, disciplined thought, disciplined action, disciplined people, and making sure we have a clear strategy. We call it the compass that spans across all the areas of the business. So it's all working together. And that's how you get the kind of repeatable, consistent results that we've generated, you know, 50% growth, 17 years in a row, Inc. 5,000, 11 years in a row. We're one of, I think, four companies that have made the list 10 times or more. So that consistency is the key, right? I'm not a venture backed organization. I don't have the benefit of just growth without worry of profits or without worry of actually building a strong foundation. If you need to be profitable. So, you know, the book is called the Building the Organization. The subtitle is the blueprint of scaling a high growth, high profit business, right? If you want to be profitable, you've got to run a very disciplined organization and make sure you're not overstaffed or understaffed, right? Make sure, you know, you're holding every dollar accountable, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. And within that, the framework of your book, going into kind of your business, you've done things with a mission in mind too. It's not just about financial gain. And you touch on that with all the things you've shared, but going into DLP and just what it stands for, and then how you've integrated the whole picture of not just developing the employees that work at DLP, but also the individuals that reside in the communities that you guys have. How has that been important, and why was that something that was important to you to try to instill in your company and try to do things in a way that help the people around you prosper as well as the people that you're around every day?
Yeah. So I think in the beginning days, we certainly didn't have it. I'd be, you know, be giving you a giant fib if I told you, hey, we had this all mapped out and all figured out. We knew exactly what we were going to do and how we were going to make an impact and whatnot. But what I did know very, very early on is that, you know, people truly are my greatest, you know, resource, asset, and investing in people was the most important thing I could do, even if it's for selfish reasons, even if it's just because I want to grow and be more profitable and so forth. That investing in people is the path to get there. Really genuinely caring. You can't fake it. Again, even if it's ultimately for, you call it selfish reasons, because you know if you care about people and you treat them right and you take care of them and you invest in them, they're going to give their all and it's going to help your business grow. Even if it was for selfish reasons, had that belief very, very early on and realized that, you know, I wanted to make a difference in the lives of those who work for me and as well as in the lives of our clients. And again, knowing that that's good for business. About 5 or 6 years ago now, you know, I did what's pretty common, I'll say, and maybe not, it's fairly common, which is I had realized I had built, you know, pretty significant wealth and said, hey, you know, I got to start, you know, giving back more intentionally and more focused. So I went out and I set up a foundation, which is a 501(c), you know, public organization is the path we went down. And it's called the DLP Positive Returns Foundation. And we started off by giving 1% of our gross income, 1% of our the capital we raise, not the actual capital, but the equivalent of, and 1% of our time to nonprofits, to doing good. And that felt really good. And very quickly, that was, you know, a lot of money, and we were doing some, you know, a lot of money in the scheme of things and doing a lot of things. And then it hit me, you know, a year or two later, I guess, that why would I want to do good with just 1% of our income, 1% of our assets? So it hit me actually when I hit 400 team members or employees, I realized that I had people working about 1 million hours a year, you know, under my direction. I could, you know, essentially direct their time and energy and effort 1 million hours a year. And at that time we were doing a few $100 million a year of revenue, and we were managing a few billion dollars of assets. And we said, well, if we have all these assets and all this revenue and all this time, why would we want to just do good with 1% or a small percent of that? We want to do good with all of it. And that's when we decided, and mostly we were already doing these things, but we got very intentional around saying, we're going to be an impact company. We're going to run impact investment funds. We're going to self-mandate the impact we're going to make. And for us, it starts with, and there's a lot of things where we focus on making impact, but it starts with investing in housing that is and remain affordable. And we started making sure we're making a positive impact in everything we do. And unlike a lot of companies out there today who talk about impact or ESG or different topics around social or environmental impact, it's often with the belief that you have to give up profits or give up returns in order to do good. That they're in conflict with each other. I believe that's not a good thing to do, and that it's much harder to do it, but that you can actually generate more profits exactly while making a difference. And it can actually enhance the profits, enhance the growth, and in turn then enhance the impact. And that's our approach. So we still do the same. We still do a lot of giving. We actually give 25% of our profits of all of our investments to our foundation. And we've got a big, hairy, audacious goal to eradicate homelessness starting in St. Augustine and our foundation. And we do a lot of things that we can't do for profit, serving the poorest of the poor in our foundation. But we want to make sure we're leveraging the platform and all the resources we have to make an impact. And so that's been, the journey we've been on. And the great thing is the type of people who thrive at DLP, the type of people that fit into our culture, the types of investors who we want to, we have 2,700 families invested with us. These are people who want to be a part of making an impact. These are people who want to make a difference. These are people who want to do good. Knowing that the hard work we do, the efforts we put out makes a difference is a huge added motivator to not just work hard, but to do the hard work necessary. And really, kind of give your all. And it's been a great journey. And very blessed today to say, I get to work every day, I get to do what I do as CEO of our organization, not at any need, not because I need to make any more profits, not because I need to generate more wealth, but because I know I'm just at the very beginning of scaling the impact we can make. And that's a really cool place to be able to operate from. And that's what we get to do, every day.
Yeah, I don't think we've touched on this yet, but how old are you today?
38.
Yeah, you're 38 and you were doing all this at such a young age, but you've had the mindset of, setting out goals to try to achieve, and you've adapted and solved problems that enabled you to jump into what you're doing today. But at the same time, I'm glad you touched on the highlight of generosity, of being generous and giving back, and how important that is to be able to, who much is given, much is expected. And I think that's
Were you in my training earlier today?
I was not. I wish I was though. So
That's funny. I'm going to show you this just so you don't think I'm making this up here. So I did this workshop training earlier today, and it's relevant to what we're talking about. I can't share my screen, but literally, my third or fourth slide of this present workshop I did for hundreds of people earlier today is Luke 12:48. Too much is
oh,
given, much will be required. So,
that's awesome. Well, it fits
love
exactly what you're talking about with DLP. And DLP
it.
stands for
Yeah,
Dream, Live, Prosper. Is that
it
correct?
does. Yes.
So yeah, you're able to do that with the people that invest in your company, that work at your company, and the people that live in your community. So I think that's great. I wish we had more time to talk, but as we wind down, I'd love to hear your perspective because, like I told, we were talking before, your perspective on being an intentional husband and father is really important. I've heard you touch on some great stuff, but in your opinion, what does it mean to be a good husband and father, and how do you go about doing that?
Thank you. And so I'll start with caveating, my children are 11, 10, and 2. So, I haven't yet successfully raised, adult children, and I can say everything I'm doing has worked, right?
We'll have you back in a couple of years then.
I think we're on the right track. I think we're doing it. But I'll start with just saying, so I used to lead a young small group, young family small groups at my church, and had all these young families come in with, new parents with 1-year-olds and 2-year-olds and 4 or 5, young children, and I'd get parents coming in and be, often worried and stressed. My child did this and I did this, or my child's acting out in this way and this is how I handled it, and worried about, did I do the right thing, right? And I used to often find myself thinking and sometimes saying that if you show up Sunday morning at 8 a.m. to being a young parent small group at church, you're probably doing okay, right? And it's the people who don't show up at 8 a.m. On Sunday to get them young, who never even think about that, right? Who probably need this time. And my point just being kind of what we talked about earlier, right? If you're intentional about it, right? I know what values I want to instill in my children. I know what I want them to learn. I know what I want to avoid with them. I have at least a belief around what are the things that will lead to a successful, fulfilled life. The things I talked about earlier, being intentional and having clear purpose and goals and growth mindset and grit. And then I not only teach these things and actively look for opportunities to create these experiences, but I live it, right? So if I want my children to believe in the value of hard work and and grit and so forth, but dad's never home, guess what? Not only are they going to think I'm a hypocrite in a lot of things I teach them, but also that's not what they're going to want, right? They're going to grow up, you know, because they're not going to have the same need per se that I have had as a young kid of no backup. And they might say, I don't want to work really hard. I don't want to run a big business. I don't want to have big responsibilities because then I'm going to have to work all the time, right? You know, I want them to see that, hey, you can have an incredible career and run an incredible organization while living fully. And I have to walk that, right? There's a great saying that says, you know, more is caught than taught, right? And I believe that applies to our children more than anything else. And so, you know, we put a lot of intentional, same practice you put in a business, right? We have a family compass in addition to our company compass, and we do family meetings every month, and we have clear family goals, and we have clear family values, and we have a family BHAG. Our big, audacious goal is a family. And this is maybe a good example of it is to have 1,000 extraordinary days in 100 different places before my oldest goes to college. And so it's an incredible process. It's us committing to actually virtual schooling our kids. And we have a full-time teacher. We didn't in the beginning, but now we do. And her husband, they travel the world for us. We travel outside of our two homes about 3 months out of the year. And then we have two different homes, and we travel, and that's part of our experience and how we want to spend a lot of time together. And spending a lot of time together is an important part of how you develop and build those values and look for opportunities to instill lessons and lots of little rhythms, you know, that we put in place to create these kind of opportunities and experiences. And I'll say just, you know, maybe one more last thing on this regard is, you know, what almost every successful person who's achieved success in their lives, they look back at their struggles, right? Everybody likes to hear. I mean, I've never been on a podcast where somebody doesn't want to hear, you know, tell me how you got to where you are to where you are today, right? Everybody wants to hear these rags to riches kind of stories. And if I didn't do a good job saying this in the onset, I'm fully know that I've accomplished what I want, not because of me, but because of him, because of the Lord and the blessings I've been provided with. But everybody wants to hear that, right? And everybody takes pride individually in their struggle and what they fought through to get to where they are. Yet as successful adults, we choose to rob our children from struggle. And we do it for all the right reasons, right? But we don't want our kids to struggle, and we try to do everything we can to avoid them from struggle and rob them from having to fight through challenges. And I know you mentioned it before we got on, but you know, one of the best examples I have of that was, you know, my oldest son in basketball. And I could come with a bunch of other ones, but I think it's a really good summary of it is my son's been a star athlete in kind of everything he does. And on the basketball team, this is a couple years back, he was, you know, second best player on his team, and by far a distant second best dribbler, which at a young age, being a basketball player, dribbling is the most important skill, and distant second best dribbler. And anyway, we're playing a really, really good team. And first half of the game, the best dribbler on the team had the ball stolen from him. Must have been 15 times, and but not even through the first half, and so much so that the boy all of a sudden had a bellyache and couldn't play anymore. Right, so he says he has to come out of the game. Dad's the head coach, I'm the assistant coach, and mom comes over and they're coddling him, and so my son takes over as point guard, and he starts having similar success or lack of success. Right, and the ball is gone. You feel embarrassed, right? You got all these parents watching you, all your teammates watching you. And you're just being, you know, outplayed. And so every time he's looking over at the sideline, his eyes are watering up, his knees hurt, his belly hurts. You know, he's about to break down in tears, right? And I had to do everything I could to not look at him because I knew if I made eye contact with him, it was over, right? And his dad, and he was, you know, first or second grader, right? You want to give him a hug. He's a little kid, but I made him stay out there the whole game. And then guess what happened? Now he came home and wanted to focus on dribbling, right? I had already been telling him, you need to dribble more, you need to dribble more, you need to be outside dribbling 30 minutes a day dribbling, you got to be two ball dribbling, you know, and didn't do it right after that. Now everywhere we go, basketball comes with us. He's outside dribbling. He's gotten incredible, so much better, right? But that struggle is what gave that motivation, that desire, that I don't want that ever happen to me again. I don't want to ever be embarrassed like that again, right? But so often as parents, we try to avoid these kind of experiences with our children.
And creating environments where they can, you know, fail but
Yeah.
succeed through the failure. And you had
Exactly.
touched on the word, I think you praise the behaviors and the activities that inspire the good results instead of just the outcomes. And when we do that as parents and as people, you'll be able to grow in your confidence in those specific behaviors and activities that you're doing. So I definitely am glad you hit that because it's a fantastic story. The final question as we wind down is this podcast is called Building Excellence. What does building excellence mean to you?
So building excellence, as I call it, building an elite organization, is our form of that, which is building, discipline, that the extraordinary or excellence becomes the norm, and it's what everybody does each and every day, day in and day out. We call that the 20-mile march we took from Jim Collins, right? Where excellence becomes the norm.
Absolutely. Well, Don, thank you so much for coming on the show, for sharing your story, the principles, the lessons, all the things that you've been able to learn throughout your journey, but also the idea behind building DLP, why you do it, your family, everything. There's lots of great takeaways in your story. If people wanted to learn more about your books, you touched on your first one, but you have another one called Building Elite Career Out. Is that correct? That was this year.
Yeah,
And
it just came
then
out about 3 weeks ago, and that's a book written to people earlier in their career. Those, if you're running an organization, to your employees, but anybody, it's half about a career, half about life. I'd call it, yeah, Building Elite Career just came out a few weeks ago. And yeah, so dlpelite.com is the website related to the books. You can download tons of free resources, tools, a lot of things we talked about and much more on there. Absolutely free. Books are on Amazon and Audible and everywhere else you get books. And then our main website's dlpcapital.com.
awesome. So if anyone wants to find out more, those are some great sites. We'll link it in the show notes. Don, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks, Bailey. Appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Building Excellence Podcast. If you found value today, we would really appreciate it if you shared the show and left a rating and review. Also, be sure to follow us on all podcasts and social platforms, as well as YouTube, where you can watch full video episodes. To learn more about the podcast or any coaching or speaking, check out baileymiles.com. Thanks again, and now go work to build excellence in your life, leadership, and legacy.